Thank you very much, and thank you for that very kind introduction. Ivan Marcus informed me that Yale University's dress code allows visitors from Israel to speak without jackets. Well, thank him for that. When they come second on an afternoon program in an unair-conditioned hall. Thank him for that indulgence. Ivan asked me to speak for about 35 minutes, which I interpret as about 40, so I'll probably end before 4:15. I'd like to thank a few people and institutions before I begin my own talk. First of all, I want to thank Ivan Marcus and Nanette Stahl for inviting me and for making all this possible. I'd like to thank the press for the wonderful job they did on Rambam Sefer Ahava, Book of Love. This is my second translation in the Yale Judaica series. And in each case, I was privileged to work with an extremely professional organization which did an extremely fine job. And I want to express my thanks to Keith Condon and everybody else at the press for the work they invested in the book. And last, I'd just like to say that I was very excited today to meet the ornament of New Haven, Rosa Maria Menocal, whose work I've admired from afar for a very long time. Danny Lasker and I are very good friends, and we email back and forth an awful lot. We even occasionally see each other or talk to each other, but mostly our friendship is electronic. And he kept telling me that his job today was to be the warm-up for my lecture. So when he said that to me about the 12th time, I thought of the story. The Pope is coming to the United States. He lands at JFK, is ushered into a limousine. He tells the driver, he says, "Look, I never get to drive. I really would like to drive a car once. Let me drive into Manhattan, and you can sit in the back seat." The Pope is not exactly a very good driver, so he's going along the Belt Parkway, speeding like crazy, and he gets pulled over by a cop. So the cop walks over to the door, looks in, jumps back, runs over to his partner and says, "I'm in really big trouble." And the cop partner says, "What's the matter? Is there somebody important in the car?" And the cop says, "I don't really know who's in it, but he must be awfully important if the Pope is his driver." So, I must be awfully important if Daniel J. Lasker warms up. What? Yes. Another couple of introductory comments more directly related to what I'm trying to do here this afternoon. The first thing is, this is the fourth of four lectures on Rambam today, and absolutely no one has told the standard and famous and widely told Rambam joke, which really surprised me. But it would explain an awful lot of what was going on over these four lectures. I first heard this from Sholem Rosenberg at Hebrew University, but I'm not sure he made it up, or it may have gone back to the 12th century or something. Do you know why Rambam is called Maimonides in the Latin, in the European languages? Because everyone has Hermonides, Hismonides, Maimonides, Thermonides. So what you're going to get today is Menachem Kellner's Monides. You're going to get my interpretation of what Rambam had to say on issues of philosophical spirituality and how they relate to the liturgy. And I'm very much aware of the fact that I'm interpreting. You're in luck that my interpretation happens to be the correct one, but it's just, as long as you realize that it's an interpretation. I want to, in effect, divide my brief remarks into four sections. In effect, it's a series of four comments. The first comment is just something introductory about the way I understand Maimonides. The second will be a few words about his notion of philosophical spirituality, the way I understand it. The third is the connection between love of God and settled liturgy, which I'll try to indicate is a serious problem. And the fourth, very briefly, some of the ways in which Maimonides' philosophical orientation finds expression in what turns out to be an extremely technical halachic text about how Jews pray, how Jews organize their prayer, how Jews write tefillin, how Jews do all the things that are described in Sefer Ahava. So first, some comments about Maimonides himself. I think it's fair to say that aside from the first Moses, Moses of Egypt, the star of the movie, and Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, or the prince, the compiler of the Mishnah, it's really hard to think of any individual whose impact upon Judaism has been dramatic as that of Maimonides. I don't mean that other people are not as important, but there are very few other figures in Jewish history whose personal impact has been great, as great. You know, Isaiah was an important figure in Judaism, But you could remove the prophet Isaiah from the Bible, and Judaism would look dramatically different. If you removed all the prophets, Judaism would look different, okay? You could remove any one of the authors of the Mishnah, or any one of the authors of the Gemara, the rabbis of the Talmudic period. You could remove any single one of them, and I don't think Judaism would look dramatically different. But if you removed Maimonides, I think Judaism as we know it today would look very different. And that's why I think it's fair to say that his personal impact may have been greater than that of any other single individual since the time of Moses. He's often compared in terms of impact to Judah Halevi, a near contemporary of his, but Halevi's impact on subsequent Jewish thought and subsequent Jewish thought has been intermittent. It's dramatic today, but over the last 1,000 years it's been more intermittent, and certainly Halevi's impact on Judaic practice is negligible, whereas Maimonides created the first comprehensive, systematic, organized, logical, geometrically laid out code of Jewish law, the Mishneh Torah, which made possible the subsequent codes of Jewish law, most well known, the Shulchan Aruch of Yosef Karo. There is no way that Rabbi Karo could have written his extremely influential code had he not had the precedent established already by Maimonides. So in that sense, I think the hagiographical statement that little Jewish children are taught, Moshe ad Moshe lo kam ke Moshe, from Moses to Moses there arose none like Moses, is actually almost a fair estimate of the facts. It's not just something that little kids are taught to recite in school. Against that background, I'd like to say that here we have to turn and say, who was this Maimonides? Which of the many Maimonides are we talking about? And I'd like to say that in scholarly circles, Maimonides is, that means the people with whom I spend my time and whose writings I read and who I hope will occasionally read my writings. In these circles, Maimonides is very often, less so today, but much more so, say, 20, 25, 30 years ago, is depicted as if he should be understood in the following context. The context begins with Plato, continues with Aristotle, with the Hellenist interpreters of Aristotle, with the Arabic interpreters of the Hellenist interpreters of Aristotle, to Maimonides, and continues on from Maimonides through Thomas Aquinas, on to Descartes, Spinoza, Leibniz, Hume, Kant, and whoever your favorite. Who's the most prominent philosopher at Yale today? You're allowed to say. Whoever it is, you know, the last in that, so far in that vector. And that's the way in which Maimonides is often depicted. This finds dramatic expression in Shlomo Pinnis's introduction to his translation of the Guide of the Perplexed, where he refers to Maimonides' halachic pursuits, his investigations and writings in Jewish law as, and I quote, an avocation. And that's a clear expression of this way of seeing Maimonides as belonging to the vector that begins with Plato and ends with the chair of Yale University's Department of Philosophy. In more tradition, who may or may not be sitting here for all I know, I have no idea. In more traditionalist Jewish circles, Maimonides is understood as existing on another vector altogether, starting with Moses of Egypt, continuing through the judges and the prophets and the rabbis of the Talmud and the Gaonim onto Moses, to Maimonides, following him through the various early scholars, later scholars, down to Rabbi Joshua Sipes, the young Israel of New Haven, whoever your rabbinic authority happens to be. And in yeshiva circles, where Maimonides is very carefully studied, at least part of Maimonides is very carefully studied, you will find that is the way in which he is understood. And I'd like to tell you an anecdote which illustrates this, and then I'll get on to more serious things. 3 years ago, my wife and I were stranded in America after 9/11, and we very much wanted to get home for Rosh Hashanah, which, like this year, is a couple of days after the weekend, after Saturday. We were in Rochester, New York. We managed to get to New York City on Friday. We spent the Sabbath here. Saturday night, we went out to the airport, hoping to get a flight back to Israel, and there were about 1,000 people waiting to get onto El Al flights. And I'm not exaggerating. They were like snaking through the terminal there at JFK. And it turned into like a block party. Everybody was like relieved to be there. They really felt like they were going to get home. And there were people who were celebrating their wedding. They just got married the day before or something, and they were handing out cake and wine. It was a very nice, it really was a very lovely affair, despite the horror that brought it about. Anyway, why am I telling you all this? Because standing behind me was a Babaver Chassid, a Chassid of a particular Chassidic court from Brooklyn, Borough Park or something, who asked me what I did. So I told him I taught at a university. And he said, what grade do you teach? Which gives me... Anyway, he was really surprised to hear I taught about Maimonides at a university, and I wanted to disabuse him. So I said, yeah, but the way I teach Maimonides is not the way you would study Maimonides in a yeshiva, because I try to teach Maimonides against the background of the books that he read and that he thought were important, books written by figures like Plato, Aristotle, Al-Farabi. This guy looks at me, looks up at me with big brown innocent eyes, and in a voice of total disbelief, he says, Goyim? He says, Gentiles? It couldn't enter his conception that one would need to study the writings of Gentiles in order to understand Maimonides. So I tell you that story because I want to emphasize that the Rambam whom I studied, whom I tried to understand, to my mind existed at the intersection of both of these vectors, and that to understand him you have to place him both in the rabbinic house of study, the Beit Midrash, and in the Philosophical Academy. And that those of my colleagues who seek to understand him primarily as a student of Aristotle are wrong, and those of my colleagues, my co-religionists, I should say, not my colleagues, who seek to understand him as exclusively a student of Torah are traditionally understood are equally wrong. Now, Maimonides himself, I think, was very much aware of the tensions that this intersection created, and he found creative ways of solving the problem, and one of which is the you might say the style of his books. I think the Mishneh Torah, the Code of Jewish Law, one volume of which we're celebrating today, is a very Jewish book. Obviously, the content is the nitty gritty of Jewish law, but its structure is Greek. The book is organized in a way that you don't find in any previous Jewish book of law. And if you look at his philosophical work, The Guide to the Perplexed, there you have a work written in philosophical Arabic, in Hebrew letters, but the language is Arabic. And the content is extremely Greek. It's philosophical argumentation. But the style is rabbinic midrash, the rabbinic homiletical exegesis. Because The Guide to the Perplexed is a book of Greek philosophy written midrashically. And it actually is. Much of it is given over to the explication and explanation of biblical words, of biblical verses, and of biblical parables and metaphors. And the Mishneh Torah, on the other hand, is a work of deeply Jewish content written, you can't say Greekly, but... written as if it were written by someone who had studied under Euclid and thought the right way to write a book was to pattern it after Euclid's elements. Now, this is that's one point. The second point is something to which Danny Lasker alluded to and the others and our colleagues this morning alluded to. Maimonides was aware of the fact that what he had to say was not going to be easily accepted by his Jewish contemporaries, and therefore he had to write esoterically. I'll perhaps address that point again in a moment. But even though he wrote esoterically, he didn't hide entirely what he was trying to do and what he had to say, and thus it's no surprise that many of his rabbinic contemporaries who understood that he was seeking to integrate rabbinic culture and philosophical culture and to write simultaneously for two very disparate audiences, but they were aware, of the strains in the, you might say, rabbinic side of it introduced by his philosophizing. And at the end of my talk, I'll get back to an example or two of that. It's not surprising they read his works and they said, this is Greek to me. Both were understanding that in both senses of the term. And this probably explains the tremendous resistance which his works aroused. We haven't mentioned it yet today, but the writings of Maimonides formed the focus of 100 years' worth of truly sharp debate within the Jewish world. So he certainly was, he is now very much a sacred cow, and he actually very quickly became a sacred cow. But we must remember that in 1232, apparently some of his books were burned at the instigation of Jews, or so it seems. So this didn't pass over quietly or simply. And let me give you an example of the kind of problematic that's involved, which will perhaps explain why he aroused so much resistance. The purer a person's monotheism is, the more transcendent must be that person's God. I'm not going to explain that. I'm just going to state that as a fact. We can argue about that later. But the more transcendent God is, the less involved that God is in the affairs of the world. But a God whose monotheism has been protected by making this God transcendent at the price of restricting this God's involvement in worldly affairs is a God which very few religious believers find satisfying. And Maimonides was in the delicate position of having to write works which were going to be read by normal Jews, we'll call them, about a God whose activity in the world he sought to restrict to the greatest extent possible. And there's another side to this. If you admit that God is strictly one, and you accept the consequence that this strict monotheism leads to almost absolute transcendence, then there's a tremendous temptation to introduce intermediaries, to find some way of getting up to God or bring God down to you. And I think Maimonides held the following view, that Moses' Torah was an attempt to protect the transcendent monotheism of God, to present a depaganized religion. And the inner meaning of rabbinic Judaism is to continue this process, this project of depaganization. But actual living, breathing Jews couldn't handle that. And we have tremendous amounts of evidence that in the 1,000 years before Maimonides, more and more Jewish texts were written, which in effect, in his eyes, and if I may say so, in my eyes, repaganized Judaism. And then I think much of what he was trying to do was to fight against that. If I may give him grades, I would say that he deserves an F in terms of the success he achieved in trying to remove these elements from Judaism. On the contrary, it's probably fair to say, and this I follow in the footsteps of Gretz and Sholem and Moshe Idel, it's probably fair to say that Maimonides' attempt to depaganize Judaism prompted the rise of Kabbalah and streams of Jewish mysticism, which were so shocked by what he was trying to do that subterranean streams suddenly burst forth out. So we have the ironic situation where Maimonides' attempt to clamp down on these things just made them that much more popular or public or well-known. Okay, all that by way of... Let me just say one more word by way of introduction, and if I keep going, the introduction will also be the end of the talk. A number of times the question of Maimonidean esotericism has come up here, and I want to add my two bits to that discussion. As I understand it, Maimonides wrote secretly out of a sense of noblesse oblige. He wanted to protect the simple Jews from the philosophically sophisticated Judaism that he was teaching. He knew, as Danny said, that if a simple person going to synagogue is told that there is no reward or punishment in the afterlife, the likely result is that the next day that person will not be in synagogue. And that's not good for that person. Maimonides, my wife always tells me to remind my audiences that his first name was Rabbi, not Professor. And he took it seriously, and he took his responsibilities to the community seriously. So I think much of the esotericism is not because he was a crypto-agnostic or a secret heretic or anything, but because the Judaism which he believed in, he knew would be dramatically destructive to the religiosity of simple or less sophisticated Jews. Okay. That by way of a long introduction to what I think Maimonides was and what he was trying to do. A few words on spirituality. It was Ivan Marcus who gave the title of this talk, and I'm responsible because I accepted it, so I'm not trying to beg off. philosophical spirituality and the love of God. Spirituality is a word which we hear a lot in our world around us. And in the sense in which, I mean, the California New Agey sense that we think of when we use it here, it has no counterpart in classical Hebrew. The modern Hebrew word ruchaniyut is basically a translation of the English word spirituality, because there was no native word for it that I know of in Hebrew. Ruchaniyut is derived from ruach, and ruach literally means breath or wind, and only derivatively spirit. By Maimonides' time, the term ruach had developed a wide range of uses, including, very importantly, an earlier expression, ruach hakodesh, the spirit of holiness, or as more usually translated, the Holy Spirit. And very differently, ruach tum'ah, the spirit of ritual impurity, often used to mean demons. The one meaning the word does not have in classic or even medieval Hebrew is spiritual, in the sense of spiritual life, as the way the word is used in California, for all I know, in Connecticut also, in our days. I think the closest one can come to this kind of expression in classical Judaism is a holy life. And if I'm going to talk about philosophical spirituality, what I want to say is a few words about how Maimonides construed the life of holiness that Judaism demanded of Jews. In other words, if he might not know how to answer us if we asked him whether he thought a Jew ought to lead a spiritual life. But if asked how a Jew ought to lead a holy life, he would have an answer. An answer, you know the classic German professor joke, you know, professor, what do you have to say about such and such a subject? Well, I wrote a book on it, right? And he pulls out the book. Well, if you ask Maimonides, how do you lead a Jewish life, a holy life, he'd say, oh, I wrote a book on it, the Mishneh Torah, the Code of Jewish Law. The Code of Jewish Law for Maimonides is his guide to how a Jew leads a holy life. But beyond that, he thinks that leading of such a life is both makes possible and is itself made possible by true love of God. And thus, in his Mishneh Torah, he opens the entire code with a book called Sefer Mada, which doesn't mean the book of science, it means the book of things that we ought to have to know. And the second volume is the Sefer Ahava, the book of love, the book which Ivan Marcus talked me into translating for the Yale Judaica series, for which, Ivan, I thank you. I didn't thank you for the last 10 years, I was cursing you, but now I thank you for What is Maimonides trying to do in the second book of the Mishneh Torah? He himself writes the following, that he included in the second book all the commandments which we have been commanded to fulfill constantly so that we love God and be ever mindful of God, such as recitation of the Shema, prayer, phylacteries, or tefillin for those of you who don't know what phylacteries are, and the priestly blessing. Circumcision is included among them since it is a mark in our flesh serving as a constant reminder even when there are no phylacteries or fringes. In other words, the Jew, the male Jew, dons phylacteries and fringes and has a mezuzah on his door and is circumcised because these are constant reminders of the way in which he is supposed to stand in relation to God. The Book of Love thus includes those commandments which are fulfilled on a regular, continuing basis in which both express and stimulate love of God. It includes practices of worship incumbent upon all Jews, and it implies that these practices strengthen love and awe of God and also teach correct doctrines about God. And institute acts of worship with such ends in view, with such ends in view. The emphasis in the Book of Love is on worship, not as reflecting love of God only, but as instilling it and also as in teaching true doctrines. Now, we all know, we heard from my predecessor, that Jews are commanded to love God, and Jews are commanded to remind themselves of that twice a day in the recitation of the Shema, and to say, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And now I'd like to say a few words about the nature of this love. What is this love which finds practical expression in the Book of Love? And what is this love which, when adhered to, leads the Jew to living a holy life? Maimonides consistently connects the love of God to knowledge of God, making love depend upon knowledge, but I would emphasize not reducing the former, namely love, entirely to the latter, knowledge. I don't think that Maimonides is a proto-Spinozist. I don't think that he would say that amor dei intellectualis means amor equals intellectualis. I think the love of God, and this is, I can't go into any, there's no way I could prove this here, that the love of God is a love which is much more than what we could call abstract knowledge. I've written about this in other contexts and do not have the time or to try and prove it here, but I think the argument is not hard to make. Maimonides did not agree with Lieutenant Commander Data in the episode of Star Trek The Next Generation when Tasha Yar died and Data, I realize these are perhaps abstract references for some of you, abstruse. Data is eulogizing Tasha Yar, and he says, to know her was to love her, to love her was to know her, to know her was to love her, to love until Captain Picard comes and shuts him up. And he was sort of like the Sorcerer's Apprentice kind of thing. He got started and couldn't stop. Every time, when I saw that episode, I said, aha, the writers of Star Trek think they understand Maimonides, but don't quite get it. Because the knowledge of God is a prerequisite for the love of God, but it is not only the love of God. And the reason I think that has to do with my take on an issue that came up in the discussion, so I'll abandon my prepared text here and refer to that. Namely, how do we understand, this is in connection with Christine Hayes' comment, how do we understand the last chapter of The Guide to the Perplexed, where after writing a very long, complex book in which Maimonides presents the intellectualist model as the ultimate, that the greatest thing a person can do is come to know God, period, suddenly in the very last chapter he turns around and says, yes, but after you've achieved the highest possible level of knowledge of God, you then have to turn around and imitate God by doing chesed mishpat utzdaka ba'aretz, loving kindness, justice, and mercy, or whatever the translation is, in the land. And I take this, and again, I can't elaborate here. I can be the German professor and refer you to my writings on the subject. But I take this as an indication that knowing God is one level. But knowing God in such a fashion that you realize that that knowledge must lead you to action. Here I'm taking a stand on one of the debates that Danny was talking about. Shows that knowledge alone is not the final step. It's there's one more frontier to be crossed, and that last final frontier is to go from abstract knowledge to behavior based upon that knowledge. And oopsie daisy, sorry, I'm getting enthusiastic. And the abstract and the behavior based upon that knowledge is the true expression of love of God. And this, I think, is perhaps helps us understand the structure, the architectonic of Maimonides' Mishneh Torah. The book of love follows the book of knowledge. And there are two things to be learned from this. One is the Lieutenant Commander Data lesson, that in order to love God, you have to know God. But I think the Mishneh Torah is not like haphazard. I think the love of God, which follows upon the knowledge of God, is the next stage up. It's not like on a level. And therefore, I think what Maimonides is subtly indicating by the very structure of the book is that in order to express our love of God, in order to express properly our love of God, we have to translate that expression not only into intellectual but into action. And you might say that the Guide of the Perplexed is the Mishneh Torah is the first, you might say, practical manual to teach how Jews at least, not obviously not non-Jews, how Jews at least translate their love into behavior. Okay. I'd now like to say a few words about a problem which immediately arises on the basis of what I've just told you. It would seem from what I've just said that there should not be a lot of room in Judaism for a settled liturgy. Let me explain why. If we are aiming at the kind of love of God which follows upon knowledge of God, as we've heard, is hard to attain. It involves years of study, of self-disciplined study of the science, science in Maimonidean terms is not exactly science in our terms, which you'll have to forgive me that one. And then metaphysics. And when a person has achieved this level of understanding, they can first begin to behave as a lover of God. Now, do you expect such a person to need to recite a set text morning, evening, and night, time after time after time after time, especially the way in which it's usually done in synagogues? Brrr. Maimonides himself tells us in the Guide of the Perplexed that that's not really what he wants to do. Let me read a short text to you. This was also referred to by Danny in his lecture glancingly. Maimonides held that the sacrificial cult is a concession on God's part. This is one of the most notorious things he wrote, and it got him into a lot of hot water with people who came after him. People could forgive a lot of the outrageous, in quote marks, or without quote marks, things that Maimonides wrote, but his successors, and most prominently Rabbi Moses ben Nachman, Nachmanides, just went berserk over this notion that the sacrifices really should not have been commanded. Now let me digress for a moment to explain why this made Maimonides' successors so upset and uncomfortable. Their conception of Judaism, and I've learned a lot about this by reading the works of Christine Hayes over the last couple of years, their conception of Judaism involved a notion that, in effect, I'll put this in crude terms, you can accomplish things by pushing buttons. And if you don't push the buttons, you can't accomplish the thing. Sacrifices, bringing sacrifices properly, do things in the universe. Reciting the set liturgy in the proper fashion, with the proper intention, at the proper time, in the proper language, has actual effects in the universe. This notion is called theurgy, where you affect God. It becomes, in another language, extremely important in Kabbalah, in medieval Jewish mysticism, where certain behaviors down below help reintegrate divinity up above. Now, and the sacrificial cult, which you got to remember is a big part of the Hebrew Bible, of the Pentateuch at least. If the sacrificial cult is so central in biblical Judaism, that it's not surprising that later Jews interpreted it as something having significance all of its own. Judah Levi, for example, Maimonides' immediate predecessor, and you might say that Halevi wrote his Kuzari against Maimonides before Maimonides. It shows you how great Halevi was. He wrote the Kuzari against Maimonides before Maimonides was even born. But for Halevi, in order for a prophet to prophesy, in order for a Jew to achieve a higher level of spirituality in any way you understand the term, he has to bring, or she has to bring, sacrifices. So Maimonides tells us that the sacrifices were a concession on God's part to the primitive pagan character of the Jews leaving Egypt. Okay? There's a gentleman here who looks just like Benny Begin who likes that idea. Let me read you, against that background, let me read you a brief passage from the Guide of the Perplexed about this. Jews in the time, pardon me, this is my words, and I'll get into Rambam in a minute. Jews in the time of the Exodus had become accustomed to worship God with sacrifices. This being so, God's wisdom and, now quote, gracious ruse, which is manifest in regard to all his creatures, did not require that he give us a Torah prescribing the rejection, abandonment, and abolition of all these kinds of worship. Had God done so, this is Kellner again, the Israelites coming out of Egypt would not have been able to accept the Torah. In explaining this, Maimonides offers an analogy. This is the part that's important for our purposes. Just as the Israelites coming out of Egypt could not relate to worship without sacrifices, so also, Jews of Maimonides' own day could not relate to worship without ritual and prayer. This is the analogy he himself uses. Demanding of the ancient Israelites that they worship without sacrifices was as impossible as sending a prophet today, in Maimonides' time, although I don't think things have changed too much, who, now I quote Maimonides, calling upon the people to worship God would say, God has given you a Torah forbidding you to pray to him, to fast, to call upon him for help in misfortune. Your worship should consist solely in meditation without any works at all. Now from this it's clear that for Maimonides, the ideal worship of God has nothing to do with reciting said prayers in any prayer book. This would put art school out of business, but it would certainly indicates his position here, that the established liturgy is a concession. It's an accommodation on God's part to the primitive character, the unsophisticated character, perhaps the childish character of the Jewish people. So now we have a bit of a problem. I spent a lot of time translating a book which is all about the set liturgy. And forget the time I spent translating. That's Bubka's. My mommy spent a lot of time writing it. And I must say that the Mishneh Torah is not a code in the sense that, you know, you pick one from column A and column B, and he just didn't compile. Every single paragraph there reflects a thought process which I think covers the entire range of Jewish law. He distills a vast amount of material into a very focused fashion. So it's, you know, I could compile a code, I don't know, the Code of Connecticut or something, just by reading a bunch of law books and trying to put them in order. But he didn't have a bunch of law books. He had a much more inchoate body of literature, which he managed to control without assistance, without computers, without programs, all in his own head. So when I say he invested a huge amount of labor in the Book of Love, I mean it literally. It's every single paragraph in the Mishneh Torah is an expression of tremendous brilliance. One of my colleagues at the University of Haifa put it to me like this. He says the Mishneh Torah contains 14 volumes and roughly, I think it's like 65 or 70 discrete sections. Each one of those sections represents the kind of academic work that would get somebody a tenure chair at Yale or Harvard. Oh, I shouldn't have said that second place, I'm sorry. But that's a rough idea of the amount of effort that was, the upshot of the work that was put into this code. But in any event, so why did he do all this? Why did Maimonides devote so much effort to establishing a code of laws which he himself thought were a concession on God's part to the unfortunate character of, you might say, Jews in our dispensation or people in our dispensation? In a more perfect world, such as that to be ushered in by the Messiah, one would expect, or one might suspect, that these things would no longer be necessary. They would be, that prayer would be superseded by worshipful contemplation of God. But Maimonides would never say that, and doesn't say that, even with respect to sacrifices. He opens his description of the Messiah by saying one of the first things the Messiah will do will rebuild the temple and reinstitute the sacrificial cult. Now I'm about to do something really unfortunate. I've asked, I think, a very good question. I don't have a very good answer. Ah, thank you. I've got 2 minutes to finish, and I'm almost finished, actually. I think the reason, and now I'm just going to really just throw out a theory that has no, it can't be proven. Maimonides was not an halachic positivist. He was convinced that all of the laws of the Torah, including the laws of sacrifice and the laws of prayer, expressed God's perfect understanding of human nature. In other words, even if we don't need the sacrifices, even if we had reached such a high level that we wouldn't need them, there would still be messages and lessons in them that would be worthwhile to be reminded of. Because he doesn't think that they are arbitrary in the sense that God just any old which way decided on these things. Furthermore, he was also committed to the Torah as a system. And I think he was committed to this system in the sense that it had to be accepted all or nothing. It's not the kind of thing that works if you pick and choose. In other words, once given, halakha is halakha. And it's no longer important why it was given the way it was given. There are all kinds of historical explanations in Maimonides' works for why it's forbidden to wear linen and wool, why the red heifer is burned to purify the impure and all. All these reflect specific historical circumstances, but he nowhere indicates or hints that once the circumstance ends, the obligation to fulfill the commandment ends with it, because he sees the Torah as a manual of discipline which doesn't work in a dislocated fashion. So, summarize my lame attempt to answer what I think of as a very good question. I think that Maimonides sees all aspects of the Torah as expressing God's wisdom and sees it as a system which cannot be picked apart without destroying the whole thing. Okay, I want to take 2 more minutes. Thank you very much. I want to take 1 minute to say the following. When Ivan Marcus tried to talk me into translating the Book of Love, I asked my son Avinoam for advice. If I may add, he's an extremely eligible 33-year-old bachelor in Jerusalem. I'm willing to talk to anybody about that after the lecture. Anyway, Avinoam said to me, "Go ahead, Abba, do it. You'll probably write lots and lots of articles or find all kinds of interesting philosophical issues in the book. So you can spend a few years writing articles on Maimonides' philosophy of prayer while you're translating the Book of Love." Well, my son was wrong. As far as juicy philosophical content, the Book of Love could have been written by Bertrand Russell's Professor Dry as Dust 80s. It's really very, very straightforward halakhic material, very nitty-gritty kinds of things. But I went through with a fine-tooth comb, and I found about a dozen places. This was actually going to be the subject of my lecture when I originally conceived it, but I'm not going to give it at all. I found about a dozen places where you could, I think, find indications of Maimonides' philosophical sensibility bubbling up through the halakhic text. And now, here's my last point. You can take that claim. Let's say I'm right. There are roughly a dozen places in the Sefer Ahava where Maimonides' philosophical sensibility bubbles up through the text. And you can read that in one of two ways. You can say, wow, here is this tremendously technical work, and still he found a dozen ways to inject his philosophical ideas. Or you can say, ha! You think he's so much of a philosopher, he wrote 200 pages of halakha and only bothered to inject philosophy into it in a dozen places. Each of you will have to choose which of those each of those ways of seeing this bubbling up of philosophy into the halakha appeals to you most. I have no set opinion on the subject. On this, there is no Kelnerian truth. Okay, let me just close by repeating what I tried to do here, was explain a little bit about the kind of Jewish philosopher Maimonides was, say a few words about the notion of living a holy life and love of God and the problem of a set liturgy, and ended with this last comment about philosophical bubblings in the Sefer Ahava. I thank you very much for your attention and welcome your questions.